If you've ever seen a cartoon in your life, you've probably seen the work of Ron Campbell. Beginning in the late 1950s in his native Australia, Campbell had a 50-year career as an animator and director of some of the most iconic TV shows that have ever graced a Saturday morning, from Popeye and Crazy Cat to DuckTales and Rugrats. In the 60s, he became involved with the wildly popular animated show starring the Beatles. That led him to working on the movie Yellow Submarine. Ron Campbell is retired now and takes his artwork from those days to various art galleries around the world. I spoke with him this year and asked how he got his start in the business.
I got into the business, actually, as a seven-year-old, you know, that began a lifetime of grim determination in a country where there was no industry, no animation industry at all. But fortunately, when I came out of art school, television had just arrived in Australia. And for the first time, there was a demand for animation to make television commercials. So I was able to walk around the streets of Sydney pretending I knew how to make animated television commercials. And by doing, I learned.
And how did you get further into the business? Doing the commercials, I imagine you must have been good at it.
Well, I was apparently able to do it to the satisfaction of the advertising agencies. And then an American company came snooping around in Australia looking for production help. That company was King Features of New York. And they brought with them the possibility of contracts to make Popeye cartoons, other cartoons like Crazy Cat and Beetle Bailey. And I found myself doing that for King Features. And that worked out okay. I was able to deliver on budget and on time. Then I got a telephone call in the middle of the night. I was in Sydney, and I was getting the call from New York, Al Brodax of King Features. And he said, "Ron, we've just sold a show for next season. We'd like you to direct all the episodes we plan to produce in Australia. Would you be interested?" And I said, "Oh, absolutely, Al. What's the show?" And he said, "It's the Beatles." And I stopped and, "Beatles? Al," I said, "insects make terrible characters for children's television." He said, no, it's the Beatles, the rock and roll group sweeping the nation, you know. And I'd only barely heard of them, I'm afraid, but I quickly learned who the Beatles were.
Well, you'd already done Beetle Bailey, so you had half of it.
Yes, right. That's true.
So how involved were the Beatles involved at all in this?
Well, they were involved in a very, very significant way and also utterly uninvolved. The significant way, of course, was that they gave us the right to use their music, which was everything. And then they went away and did their music thing, and we went away and did our cartoon thing. And so we had an enormously successful television show, thanks to their music. And it was a fun show, and children all over America loved the show. And now that I'm doing art shows, I'm meeting that audience in person, and I am amazed at how many millions of people, millions of Americans, still think back to that happy time when they were watching the Beatles cartoon television show. It had like, sometimes it had like a 67 share. That meant every 100 TV sets that were turned on during that time period, 67 of them were watching the Beatles, our Beatles TV cartoon show. An amazing thing that could never happen today.
I will confess right now that one of those TVs was in my living room. I watched it every week. Yep.
See, wherever I go, I meet people who were little children at that time watching that show. It's amazing.
I'm interested in learning. You said you were directing the show. How does one direct a cartoon?
Well, in those days, it meant a lot more than it does now, actually. In those days, it meant I decided how many people were to be employed, who was to be employed, how did the workflow go. I did the storyboards. New York sent me a voice track and a script, and I delivered to them a finished film. And I was responsible for everything. That's how you directed a show then. And I was 24 years old. How did I have the knowledge to do that? I don't know. I look back, somehow I did, you know, and I think it was because I taught myself, you know.
From that, how did you go from that to getting involved in their movie?
Oh, the movie was different. After the success of The Beatles, I did another TV show called Cool McCool for King Features. And then I started getting a lot of job offers from the United States. So I packed my beautiful wife up and my lovely little three-year-old daughter, and we flew across the Pacific and we joined the American animation industry. I worked for a year for Hanna-Barbera, and then I started my own company. And while helping out on the first season of Scooby-Doo, doing storyboards and animating a show you might have heard of called George of the Jungle and Tom Slick and Super Chicken.
These are amazing shows you're bringing up right now. These are great.
Yeah, I get another telephone call from New York. Not New York. Al was in London when he called me. And he told me that there was a lot of problems in the production of the film they were making called The Yellow Submarine, and that they needed character animation between the songs, and they needed a lot of help. Could I help out? And I was working with a very good animator at that time, and a very close personal friend of mine. His name was Dwayne Crowther. I agreed, and Dwayne agreed to help out with this. And so we took on the task of doing about 12 minutes of the animation of The Yellow Submarine, just the animation. They sent the scenes to us in Hollywood, and Dwayne and I animated the scenes with a few assistant animators helping us. And we sent all the pencil drawings back to London, where they inked and painted them and painted the backgrounds, filmed them, and slipped the scenes into the movie where they belonged. We did about 12 minutes, just 12 minutes of the film. We're not responsible for the magnificent design and everything that's really good in the film, except we did provide them with some great character animation on the Blue Meanies and Max the Assistant and the Nowhere Man. We did about 12 minutes, as I say, and it took us 8 months to do.
Wow.
So, you know, all of the magnificent stuff on The Yellow Submarine was really done in London by TVC, by Heinz Edelman and all the directors in London. They did a marvelous job on the film, and the film has stood the test of time. It was released just a couple of years ago to enormous success again. Nobody has ever watched that film without being influenced by it in some way.
I want to go back to a show that might have been one of the first things you worked on. I'm not sure. I remember it as a kid. Is Winky Dink and You? It says you worked on that.
Are you going to mention? Winky Dink? Oh my goodness!
Not many people will go from the Beatles to Winky Dink. I'll tell you.
I have to tell you, of all of the shows that I've worked on, and I've given 10 years of my life to the Smurfs and 10 years of my life to Rugrats. And you mentioned Winky Dink.
Well, that's because I was part animator in that show, too. The kids had to draw on the screen.
Yeah, you did. Yes, it was a real strange thing, which was kind of strangely popular with small children. And sometimes it got the children into trouble with their parents because they didn't get the screen. They actually drew directly onto the TV set.
I can confirm.
So, you know, what can I say about Winky Dink? It was just a little sideways thing that I forgot all about until the computer comes along and tells everybody what you did, even things that you forgot you even did, you know?
Well, it sounds like you also were very involved in the creation of Scooby-Doo, and I can't think of many cartoon characters more popular than that in the U.S.
Well, I was just involved really in the opening scene of it, and there was some preamble stuff the year before, doing storyboards on the very first season, and then later on in the 70s, I subcontracted a few episodes for Hanna-Barbera, where my studio was across the road from Hanna-Barbera, and Bill Hanna used to send subcontract stuff to Overflow Production to my studio.
Does the job that you started doing even exist anymore? Hand animation, I'm talking about.
Oh, I see, yes. Virtually no, it doesn't exist anymore. Right now, if you look at feature films that are generated by computers, they're just technically so far advanced from anything that can be done by hand. On the other hand, I'm not sure that the computers have been helpful for television entertainment for children. But there is a charm that hand-drawn animation brings to the imagery that computers cannot compete with. But there are many things the computer can do that no hand-drawn animation could even remotely come near. So it's like a different medium altogether. And right now, hand-drawn animation is not that popular. It will come back, I know, because it does have a charm that no computer can touch.
Ron Campbell spent 50 years as an artist, animator, and director. You can see his exhibition at BeatlesCartoonArtShow.com. Still to come, we'll hear from an artist who illustrated her experience with bipolar disorder in a pair of graphic novels. That conversation's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. When I watched Ellen Forney's TED Talk, I was taken by the courage it took to talk about living with bipolar disorder in front of a crowd. It turns out she has a lot of experience in being open with her life. Forney is a cartoonist and mental health advocate who wrote the New York Times best-selling graphic memoir, Marbles, Mania, Depression, Michelangelo, and Me, the story of her diagnosis and struggle with bipolar disorder. She also wrote Rock Steady, Brilliant Advice for My Bipolar Self, a guide to maintaining mental health. We spoke earlier this year, and I asked why she felt her story was one she needed to tell.
I knew that it was a story I needed to tell for a number of different reasons. I mean, for one, I knew for me, I'm a storyteller. As a cartoonist, I'm a storyteller by trade. And in order to kind of work out how to think about certain difficult things in your life or the way that things roll out, especially something as complicated as bipolar disorder, looking back and trying to make sense of things. But the reason that I did it as a story for other people and not just for myself is a way to help others in the way that I had been helped, for example, by a couple of different memoirs. One was Kay Jamison's An Unquiet Mind about her bipolar, and William Styron wrote Darkness Visible about his suicidal depression. And I wanted to be able to add my voice, my story, in a way to give other people company. And because I work in comics using words and pictures and a lot more space on the page and a different way of expressing very internal things like emotions and moods, I felt like I had something to offer that hadn't really been offered before. So to help other people in a medium that I feel very passionately about as a storytelling medium.
Were you at all worried or concerned that it being a graphic memoir instead of just a regular old book, that it wouldn't be taken as seriously?
Well, I think, yes. I think it's an issue that I've grappled with for my whole career, really. I started as a professional cartoonist in 1992, and graphic novels and comics in general have gained in respect many, many times since the early 2000s, and then more and more all the time. I remember it was a big deal when the New York Times started reviewing comics. So I think that it's still kind of on its wave of credibility, kind of made its way into academia, and it's much more slowly but steadily making its way into the sciences, like medicine. There's a field called graphic medicine that this is definitely a part of, communicating stories by patients generally, but also by caregivers, and it's a very powerful way to tell these stories of health. Actually, I curated an exhibit for the National Library of Medicine about graphic medicine. It's really powerful and getting more and more recognized.
That was the one called Ill-Conceived and Well-Drawn?
Yes, indeed.
What was that? Talk about that just for a second. I read that you did that, but I couldn't really find what it was.
So that specifically was it was a traveling exhibit. So it's still traveling. It's in libraries and universities throughout the country, and I guess theoretically internationally, but I haven't looked at the list of places that recently. That explains what graphic medicine is, which is kind of the intersection of storytelling and comics and health and caregiving, and really explains how comics work, how words and pictures combine, and how powerful that is, and then also a whole bunch of examples of graphic memoirs and other kinds of comics about mental illness. My own comic, Marbles, Mania Depression, Michelangelo and Me, is featured in it. And then also comics about breast cancer and caregiving by a nurse, M.K. Zerwick, about caring for AIDS patients in the 90s. And it's a way for people to recognize what the personal experience is like for a patient or for somebody who's going through it. And then also as a way for people dealing with certain health issues to communicate with caregivers. It's a way to really explain the experience in a very vivid, kind of a visceral way.
Well, telling your story by telling it in a book and drawing it is one thing, but getting up in front of people and talking about it, that's taken another step. How did that evolve? I talk for a living, and I couldn't do it in front of people doing something that personal.
Uh-huh. Well, I think just the same as anybody who does a book reading about a memoir, it's a thing to get in front of a whole lot of people and talk about something that's intimate. But if you've already put it out as a book, then we have to have some level of familiarity, some level of recognition that other people are privy to our stories. And so telling our stories openly in person is just, in some ways, just another variation on that. And I've taught for years, so getting up in front of a bunch of people and talking and doing my best to know what I'm talking about and keeping everything in order is something that I enjoy, really. I love giving talks. I really do. I love being able to talk with people in person and the kind of energy in a room that you can get. It's very different from a book. I mean, and a book has its own thing. There's a certain intimacy with a book. You hold it, and it's just you and this object. And the intimacy, I think, is that much more with a comic because it's hand-lettered and it's drawn, and you really get a sense of the author, of the cartoonist. So a book is a powerful experience in itself. So having a person, having that personal interaction with a talk and the audience and the book signing afterwards where I get to meet people one-on-one, it's a very different way of connecting with a story. I really enjoy both aspects of that.
You know, I never thought of it, but you're right. It's hand-lettered. That's an artwork all by itself. Most comics, you know, they give them to letterers who do that for a living.
Well, it varies from cartoonist to cartoonist. I would say a lot or most indie comics, so not the mainstream ones, not the kind of superhero ones, are hand-lettered, or sometimes a font that looks like hand-lettering. But one of the things about hand-lettering, it really is that intimacy and immediacy. I mean, think about getting a letter in the mail that's handwritten, or when somebody writes you a card and it's handwritten, there's some real reflection of their personality and who they are, and you know that they have touched that paper. And so reading a book that's hand-lettered really gets at the immediacy of the connection with the author.
When you do these talks, do you think you get as much out of it as the audience does?
Oh, I think it's very different what I get out of it and what the audience does. Well, I don't know what would that relationship be. I mean, not exactly a teacher and a student, but maybe something like that, in that I feel that I have something important that I want to share. I mean, I wouldn't be getting up there if I didn't feel like I had something important to share. And to see and really feel that people are processing that and getting something that they can incorporate personally into their own lives is all I can hope for, really. I mean, telling my own story isn't just about me. It's all about me. Because, I mean, that only has so much value, really, I think. That the hope is that my story has certain universal qualities. And whether that's to somebody who actually has bipolar and has maybe never seen anybody get up in front of a bunch of people and talk about it, or whether it's someone who is having a trouble having hope for overcoming something difficult, and maybe it's the hope and going through a journey and coming to the other side of it. But the idea that I might be able to help other, show other people, tell other people a story that they might find motivating or inspirational is really where that comes from. So I get a lot out of it, though it's something very different from the experience that I hope the audience gets.
Talk about the second book for a while. That was just released last year or the year before, Rock Steady.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a continuation of the story?
Well, it's the companion book. One of the things that was important to me in Marbles, which is my own personal story from my diagnosis through my 4 years of struggle to figure out how to be stable, I put in a number of pages on different coping tools, really. So like, rather than saying, I tried cognitive behavioral therapy and only one exercise was really helpful for me, I actually said that, but then put that exercise in to the book in a way that my readers could actually do it. I have some breathing exercises in there and some other things similarly informational. And a lot of people told me that it was really helpful and that they used Marbles, my memoir, as a manual. And I just know there's so much that didn't fit into Marbles along those lines. And there's so much more that I would have wanted to say about coping tools and the things that I've learned over the years. I mean, I've been stable now for 18 years, and I've learned a lot. And I also love research. And so I put together basically a handbook for maintaining mental health. It's specifically geared towards addressing issues around bipolar and mood disorders, but a lot of it is applicable for everyone. I can rattle this off really quickly. My overall system, uh-huh. I have an acronym for it, of course, is SMEDMERTS. And there's a little mascot, this little kind of like toothy monster with basically doing jazz hands. And it's sleep. The absolute first thing for all of us is getting enough sleep, medications. That's for people who take medications, obviously. Eating well and seeing your doctor or sticking with those things that help your health. Mindfulness and meditation. Calming yourself down is so difficult, and really it takes practice. And then we're up to E for exercise. Taking care of your body is so important. A routine, a good routine. Plenty of coping tools, that's T. And the last S is a solid support system, because it's just too much to do for anyone on our own. So it's this wide variety of things that are all interconnected that are all essential, really, for us to take care of our mental health.
Well, finally, do you still consider yourself a crazy artist?
Well, you know, there's no cure for bipolar. So in that way, I say I'm crazy. I'm comfortable with the word crazy, although I do say it a bit tongue in cheek. So I would say yeah, I'm a crazy artist, but like with the jazz hands.
The name of Ellen Forney's latest book is Rock Steady: Brilliant Advice from My Bipolar Life, and we'll include a link to her TED Talk on the T-Book page at wamc.org. Well, if 2020 has taught us anything, it's that we really need a healthy sense of humor to get by. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How important is a sense of humor? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Janet Gibson, professor of psychology, explores how laughing can make a big impact on your psychological well-being.
Humor is experienced in all cultures, from infancy through old age, but only in recent decades has experimental psychology respected it as an essential, fundamental human behavior. Historically, psychologists framed humor negatively, suggesting it demonstrated superiority, vulgarity, Freudian id conflict, or a defense mechanism to hide one's true feelings. In this view, an individual used humor to demean or disparage others, or to inflate one's own self-worth. As such, it was treated as an undesirable behavior to be avoided, and psychologists tended to ignore humor as worthy of study. In writing an undergraduate textbook on the psychology of humor, I found that now various psychology perspectives present extensive research on how we detect, comprehend, appreciate, and produce humor. Psychologists note that humor can be used to make others feel good, to gain intimacy, and to help buffer stress. Further, in positive psychology, a field that examines what people do well, humor is viewed as a character strength. A sense of humor, along with gratitude, hope, and spirituality, help us forge connections to the world and provide meaning to life. Appreciation of humor correlates with other strengths too, such as wisdom and love of learning. And doing humor-focused activities and exercises may result in increased feelings of emotional well-being and optimism. While we may not agree on what's funny and what isn't, there's more consensus than ever among experimental psychologists that humor is serious and relevant to the science of behavior.
And that was Janet Gibson of Grinnell College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.